and I, this is so strange because this happened this past week, on the back bumper, there was a Shut Up Weirdo sticker outside Atlantic City, which made me very happy.
What kind of car was it?
It was like a Honda Civic. It was the four-door one.
Mm.
Was it you gambling?
It was me. I have a Honda Civic.
I think it was Tom Sharpling. Well, he has a Honda Civic.
I'm just kidding.
No, he has a Honda Accord. I'm sorry. Honda Accord, not Civic.
No, it was not me.
Well, that's not the real mind-blowing one. Here's the real mind-blowing one. Well, so I went to school up this way, and to college, and, you know, I was visiting a friend in New Brunswick maybe about, you know, 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
He went to Rutgers. And we always ate breakfast at this one coffee shop, right?
Hensel and Griddle?
Like lunch or whatever.
What's yeah.
Yeah, West End Cafe. It closed down now, but it was awesome. But the guy there who owned it was, you know, he was kind of a jerk to us sometimes. And we didn't really understand why, because, I mean, we just came in, you know, ordered coffee and ate in peace, and, you know, didn't really talk to anybody. But anyway, the one girl working there was actually a really nice person. And she was really nice to us and things like that. And we had this conversation about how we both wanted to study abroad in the United Kingdom for a creative writing degree, you know, something super dumb like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had this conversation or whatever, and the place closed down, what have you. All right, whatever. So 4 years later, I'm in the UK studying abroad, trying to get that degree, and this girl is there at the same place I am in outside London. And I'm like, you know, I recognized her, and then, you know, we started talking about it. And I'm like, oh, it's so crazy. Oh my
God.
Did
you guys have sex?
What a strange coincidence. I mean, no, that would have been pretty cool, but it didn't end
that. That would have sealed the deal.
So to speak. So,
anyway, I was like, you know, I used to love that coffee shop. She came and closed down, whatever. But man, like, I was such a huge jerk. He would kick us out sometimes for all this other stuff. Like, you know, I used some other words to describe him and things like that. We were throwing back some beers. And then she's like, oh, well, that's because, you know, that guy had cancer and his kid had cancer. And I was, like, helping to, like, care for his family and stuff. And then I felt like a huge jerk.
You are a huge jerk.
Yeah.
Just kidding.
Was,
I think
I
you're a
that
nice
was pretty
guy.
Mind-blowing.
That's pretty good. I like that one. But it's not a winner.
Well, did I win last week? I mean,
I don't know. What's your name?
What's that?
What was last week?
When I found a freaking rocking horse in the weird room in that.
No. Chris from Brooklyn won last week with the enema room.
Another Chris? What was in the room?
An enema device.
An enema table.
Oh, like a whole table.
I didn't respond to him, but Chris and I both went online to look for an enema table, and there's like no such thing.
So he made it up?
Well, no. Well, I mean, there's. It was like either made homemade or made of something else. There's like medical exam tables.
Ew. Okay, anyway, thanks for calling, mister. Have a good one.
No problem. See ya.
There's, like, chiropractic therapy tables that, like, tip you upside down like that.
Don't forget there's a Shut Up Weirdo Tuesday at 6:30 at Luca Lounge.
222 Avenue B in the East Village,
Details
Manhattan.
Are on our website, shutupweirdo.com, as well as our Facebook page.
Why are you trying to end the show so fast?
I just want to say it before I forget.
Oh. By the way. Oh.
I'm answering this call now. Hansel FMU, you're
Griddle.
On the air.
Hello?
Hi.
Hey, Frandry.
Good evening.
Hi, yeah, so I just want to say for the topic, things that blew my mind. Frangry, you are definitely one of them.
Oh, Jesus.
I don't know if you remember, but we used to date a while back.
What's your name?
My name's Kevin.
Yeah, I never dated a Kevin, but nice try.
I did.
All
right, thanks for calling, Kevin. What did he scream?
You would. I don't know, it was kind
don't
of a Howard Dean thing. I don't know what that was.
FMU, you're on the radio.
Hey.
Hi.
I'm on the radio?
Yes.
On the radio?
Yeah, live.
On air.
Oh, okay. My name is Erica.
Hello.
Uh-huh.
And here's what blew my mind. a saint spoke to me. And I'm not even religious. Mm-hmm. I was raised Catholic. I didn't really bring any of that with me. But I have this friend who's like the most down-to-earth person ever. And she has these three kids who are also really down to earth. And apparently she had been, like, rejecting St. Michael into her life, she said, her entire life until she was 45. And then St. Michael would, like, tell her to go do, like, all these things. And I didn't really believe her. And then one day we were walking down Montague Street in Brooklyn. And this girl, this woman, my friend, she stopped me. I was, like, feeling real lousy or whatever. Somebody dumped me. and the patron saint of mental illness came to speak to me.
I'm sorry, Saint Michael?
No. Well, yeah, Saint Michael was there because he's always around. Saint Michael's always like hanging around her. But the patron saint of mental illness is Saint Dimphna. Of all the saints, I get Saint Dimphna, who's patron saint of mental illness. So she was like standing there next to my friend. Well, I think Saint Michael was in between them because he's like always around. And she said, "You're going to be okay. I love you. Come back to me."
Oh, come
and that blew
on.
My mind. Like a real bona fide Catholic saint. And what was the weirdest thing about it
was
is she floating? No, I didn't see her. My friend could see her.
What was she wearing?
But I felt this weird shiver go across my collarbone, and then I told her about it.
Ghosts.
And
I told you, Andy.
And I used to wear a necklace and wasn't wearing it. She was like, "You need to go put on that necklace."
All right, thanks for calling. We have to end the show.
You seem a good one. You seem skeptical, Frangry.
I do. I even cursed on that one. That was that was BS. Let me just say it. Mark and McCarr and Marf, you are both winners.
In your book.
Yeah, in my book and in every listener's book. Email me your address and t-shirt size at shutupweirdo@wfmu.org.
So you're actually going to give two prizes this week.
Yes, I am.
Hey,
you know what? They deserve it. They really do.
If they come to the meetup, you can give them their prizes in person.
Yeah, I can.
And hug them and kiss them.
Yeah. Listen to I'm Worth It at 7:30. You can find the link at WFMU.org.
Okay. You have been listening to Shut Up Weirdo here on WFMU. You can comment during the show at WFMU.org. You can write us at shutupweirdo@WFMU.org. We have a website, shutupweirdo.com.
Jesus, Andy, that's like you added more information. You're making it longer, not shorter.
And now you're making it longer by interrupting me.
Maybe you just shouldn't say it. Just do the station ID and let's close the show.
ShutUpWeirdo.com has links to Facebook, Twitter, and iTunes, plus our archives, as you made at the beginning of the show. Up next, Stuff You Should Know, 8 o'clock, Mr. Fine Wine. You are listening to The Boxcar, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, live and archived at WFMU.org. So let's
end it here.
Time for Josh and Chuck and Stuff You Should Know, the program that exposes the internal workings of life on this planet. This is the radio version of the Stuff You Should Know podcast, which is available from HowStuffWorks.com. Tonight, Josh and Chuck discuss riots and how to control them. And then in part two, they take a look at five successful counterfeiters. Now here's Josh and Chuck.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuck Bryant, and this is Stuff You Should Know, the podcast.
Are you waiting on me?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is, Josh.
Did you see Mark Maron?
What do you mean?
He toppled Ira Glass for a few days.
I did see that.
Out of nowhere.
Yeah, he must have had some sort of little publicity push or something.
Something.
Something happened.
Yeah, it's great for him.
Yeah, he has a great show, though.
Yes, he does.
Really good interviewer, Mr. Maron. I emailed him one time, told him that.
And he was like...
No, he said, "Thanks a lot, man."
Did he?
"Who are you?"
Yeah.
He probably did, but that's fine.
Yeah, he's a nice guy.
I'm not a famous comedian.
No.
Not yet.
No. Chuck, did you ever watch WKRP in Cincinnati?
Oh, you know I did.
Yeah?
Uh-huh.
So do you remember the one, like, every once in a while, Different Strokes would do this, too. There'd be like... at the end of the episode, when it was really serious,
I know where you're going.
There would be no clapping. It'd just be quiet, right? But you could tell the audience was still there. There was always somebody moving in their seat or coughing or whatever. So, like, the audience was just sitting there being silent, which threw a pall over the entire episode.
Yeah, because you're used to hearing the laughing.
It was jarring.
Yeah.
And even as a lad, I remember thinking, like, wow, something big just happened that I wasn't paying attention to, you know?
Uh-huh.
And there's a particular WKRP episode that stands out that was like that. The one where they sponsored the Who concert where those people got trampled.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
Did you see that one?
Oh, yeah. I remember. I knew where you were going with this.
So this happened in real life. There was a Who concert in Cincinnati, and it was general admission seating, which apparently did away with general admission for a while.
Yeah, open the gates and run to wherever you want to go.
Now, there was like a sound check, and people mistook the sound check for an early start. It was a late sound check, and they thought it was an early start.
Right.
So people started pushing in. Well, I guess the people who owned the theater had fewer entrances open than they could have.
Mm-hmm.
So this mass of people just started pushing forward, and some people got pressed against the doors and were asphyxiated by this huge crowd.
Yeah, people were trampled to death.
Yes.
Awful.
To this day, I mean, you can explain what the trigger was, but to this day, there's a lot of study that has come up empty-handed to that kind of crowd behavior.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's called. It's the study of crowd behavior. People as individuals act differently when they submit to a larger collective group.
A quote-unquote mob mentality?
That's part of it, too.
Yeah.
But things like that stampede, Black Friday stampedes. Have you ever seen video of those?
Oh, dude.
They're nuts.
Yeah.
There's one where like it ends with this guy coming into the foreground, and he's just like leaning over this railing.
Unbelievable.
At like a Target or something, and he's like got this horrible look on his face, and he's like trying to catch his breath, and like he's been trampled. And they managed to extract him. And he's sitting there, like, leaning over the railing, catching his breath. And you just know that, like, once he caught his breath, he was going to go right into the Target and start shopping.
Right.
But so all of this is called crowd behavior. And one of the big ones, the one that's really always been elusive, is rioting.
Yes.
Why riots happen. Why ordinary people behave the way they do in a riot, breaking glass, beating up people for no good reason, like stealing, looting, all this stuff, right? One thing they have kind of figured out is how to control riots, right?
Yes, they have, and they've gotten better at it over the years. As recently as 1992 in L.A. with the famous L.A. riots, which my brother lived out there at the time, they still weren't doing a great job at it.
I think that was a big learning experience itself.
Sure. 2,300 injuries, 7,000 fires.
It's like Detroit on the night before Halloween or something.
Well, we'll talk about Detroit, too. More than 12,000 arrests, $1 billion in damage after the Rodney King verdict came back as not guilty, obviously, for the four white cops who beat the tar out of Rodney King.
Mm-hmm.
And it lasted from April 29th until May 2nd. There was full-on rioting going on, streets of L.A.
Yeah.
And they've gotten better at it since then, is
Remember
my point.
Poor Reginald Denny getting shot in the leg, the trucker who got pulled out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do remember that.
That was crazy, man.
So that's what's called the mob mentality. And one of the things, this is the Grabster. Ed Grabanowski always gets the good stuff.
He's quality.
One thing he pointed out here, which is a big deal with mob mentality I never considered, is anonymity.
That is the point, right?
Yeah.
You've got a crowd of people who are like kind of all feeling the same way. At the very least, they're all feeling the same energy. But the cops are standing there staring at you.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to do anything if the cops are standing there staring at you, especially if you think you may be the only one to do something.
Right.
You're not going to throw a Molotov cocktail at a cop when you think everyone in the crowd is going to look at you like, what did you just do that for?
Right.
Right? But if you're anonymous, not just to the cops, but within the crowd, you're probably going to start something.
Yeah, it makes you do things you wouldn't ordinarily do if you were on your own.
And there's different schools of thoughts with riots, right? The prevailing idea is that riots are formed by a few people who do act as triggers once the risk of being arrested is low enough through anonymity.
Uh-huh.
A few people who are angry enough, have something to gain, there's some reason. They act as the leaders or the people who start the riots, and everybody else, which they're considered a homogenous group, right, of soccer fans or people low on the socioeconomic ladder in L.A.,
right?
They just get caught up in the mob mentality.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's pretty much how most people see riots these days.
Yeah, and that's basically every riot you just described. There's two things you need, the fuel and the spark. It's like a fire.
Right.
And it's very much accurate to call it that. The fuel can build up and usually does build up over time. In the case of L.A., it was racial prejudice and what they perceived as unfair treatment because they might have been poor.
Well, not just that. I think the LAPD has been, especially at that time, was viewed as like the most crooked police department in the country.
Sure. So this builds up over time. Maybe it's a union angry at their company, angry for years, decades even, over mistreatment. And once you get a big enough group of people that are all ticked off about something together, mm-hmm. and you have a spark, which doesn't even need to be something real. Sometimes it can be a rumor that something happened. People get whipped up to a frenzy. That spark ignites the fuel, and you've got a riot on your hands.
And that spark, another term for it, is a shelling incident. Shilling incident, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's this guy who studied crowd mentalities, crowd behavior, mm-hmm. and he, I think his name was Thomas Shilling, and a shilling incident is like a signal. It can be anything from like when you reach that peak moment where everybody's charged up,
right.
but nobody's going to do anything. If somebody suddenly shatters like a plate glass window, everybody's going to go nuts. A shilling incident has just happened. Yeah.
Wow.
But another way to put it is that spark.
Right.
But it takes something like that, a signal like it's go time.
Yeah.
For the balance to tip in a riot, a crowd to go from a crowd to a riot.
Right. Josh, we talked about in the past, they were not very good at it. And when I say they're not very good, it was because it was us versus them. Cops go in and start beating people into submission.
Yeah.
And that's not the way they want to do things nowadays.
No, it was viewed as a battle.
Yeah, like let's go out and fight each other.
Yeah, like Braveheart or the other one that he made like that.
Yeah, and we've got better weapons, cops do, so we're going to win, despite the fact that you may outnumber us. Although sometimes we might outnumber you and have better weapons.
And apparently one of the things they figured out, this happened in L.A. in 92. When you outnumber the cops back down, apparently. That's what they did in L.A. They were like, there's nothing we can do. We'll get eaten alive. So we're going to just kind of hang back and try to contain this.
Right.
You know?
Interesting. These days, it's pretty cool how they do it. There is a command team. They form a square, a big square of officers.
Yeah, and by the way, it really helps to see this graphic. Do you have that?
No.
Dude, this graphic is as helpful as a graphic I've ever seen in my entire life on the site. Yeah.
So what you've got is you've got a big square of officers. In the center of that square, you have your command team giving out the orders. They're obviously well protected because they're in the middle.
Yeah, and the outside, the sides and the front and back are called echelons, right?
Yes, and an echelon is about 10 to 12 cops mm-hmm. that are, you know what echelon you're in, so you know what to do. Like, oh, we'll get into that in a second. There's also in the center, there's an arrest team, and they are the only people that are actually placing people under arrest. Everyone has their own job.
Right.
And what I get from this is you got to stick to your job in order to be effective.
Yes.
If you're in a front echelon, don't start arresting guys.
No.
It's not your job.
No. And I think the whole thing would fall apart, like you say.
So it's very mobile, very tactical. You can change direction. If all those dudes in the square all of a sudden said, you know, the command team sends out the message, we got people coming from the south, they can all turn around, and all of a sudden you've got the same effective team going the other direction.
Right. They're very reactive.
Very
adaptable.
Reactive. The echelons cover each other. They don't all go out at once. Like an echelon, if they want to advance, they'll send out one echelon while everyone else covers them. Then the next echelon will go forward, and then what you're doing is you're moving the square into another position.
Right. And remember we said that rioting groups are generally taken as homogenous, mostly people who get caught up in the thrill of the moment.
Uh-huh.
When they're confronted with police, the idea is that they really just kind of want to go home. They don't want to get arrested. They don't have any dog in the fight.
Mm-hmm.
So if they see this tactical squad coming at them, the one of the first points of the squad is to let these people go home.
That's
to disperse.
That's what the cops want, is they just want you to get out of there.
So it's not just like this solid wall, although it can be, these echelons.
Uh-huh.
They're also very capable of spreading out to let people flow through them and get out of there.
That's what they want to do. They want to leave you an escape route, whereas in the old days, they would actually try and strategically trap you in a corner.
Right.
Which,
and
as everyone knows,
beating the tar out of you with a nightstick.
But, you know, when you're trapped in a corner, you're going to be even more enraged and scared. So that just led to more violence.
Right. So if you are confronted by an echelon of this, right? Let's say you're just an average person and you want to get out of there, you're probably going to be able to make it through or around them, right?
Yeah.
But if you're just standing there and you're throwing rocks still, or you're shouting at them, or you're not moving and they're telling you to,
yeah,
what's going to happen is they're going to close ranks, and then the two officers that you're in between
mm-hmm.
are going to open up, and you're going to find yourself swallowed by this tactical square of yeah. riot cops.
They
right?
gobble you up, basically.
And that's when you're going to be introduced to the arrest team.
Uh-huh.
You are in a walled area of cops.
Yeah.
And
that's probably not a fun place yeah, to be.
No, you're in trouble.
So, Josh, you want to talk about some of the devices these officers use
yeah.
to quell a crowd these
you're not,
days?
You're not going to go into a riot, you know, wearing Madras shorts.
No.
You know?
That's not.
You could, but you're going to be wearing them under what's called hard tack.
Yeah, I love that.
Which
phrase.
Is a helmet with a visor,
mm-hmm.
right? Body armor.
Yeah.
And not just like the it's chest armor, chest and back, but like, you know, the vest.
Right.
That's what it's called. You're going to have body armor on your arms, your legs, your shins. It's probably flame retardant.
Yeah.
And then a shield. And the shield and the face mask are made of, Lexan?
Yeah.
Which is like bulletproof, if it's thick enough. This stuff isn't thick enough. It's not intended to be bulletproof.
No.
But it's probably brickproof.
Yeah.
Or at least Molotov cocktail proof.
Yeah, exactly. That's what you're looking for. They have a baton is probably what most of these women and men, I keep saying dudes, they're probably some female riot cops,
uh-huh.
I imagine,
mm-hmm.
that are holding a baton. It's generally made of wood, about 24 to 42 inches long. And they use these instead of rifles because rifles can ignite a crowd, and you don't want someone grabbing your rifle. So they want to try and keep things as low-key as possible, initially at least.
Right.
And bringing a rifle into the fight definitely will not do that.
Well, no, not only that, but if somebody gets the rifle away from the cops...
Bad news.
Yeah.
They have non-lethal rounds, but Ed is quick to point out there's really no such thing as a non-lethal round.
Right.
Anything fired from a gun... can kill you, potentially. Just ask Brandon Lee.
Yeah.
Well, I guess you couldn't ask Brandon Lee, but look what
ask
happened
the
to Brandon
director
Lee.
Of The Crow.
And they are fired from a 40-millimeter gun, and it's one of those, sometimes it's a single shot, but it's like a grenade launcher. Sometimes it's those really cool-looking things with a 6 or 8 round barrels. Looks like a Tommy gun, sort of.
It's very cool-looking.
But they shoot out 40-millimeter shells.
Right, and like you said, they're less than lethal rounds, right?
Yes.
Less lethal. Basically you have a couple of different kinds of rounds or a couple of different categories. Like you have blunt force rounds, right?
Yes.
And blunt force rounds are basically meant to knock you on your bottom when you're in the middle of a riot.
A big thud in your chest.
Or at the very least to smack your legs and your stomach. Because if you're a rioter and you weren't planning to be in a riot that day, you may be wearing Madras shorts.
That's right.
Right? And so these rounds, these blunt force rounds, there's the wood baton, the rubber baton, the foam baton. All of these are designed, they look like little canisters
mm-hmm.
that are shot from these grenade launchers.
And they're filled with these things, right?
They're filled with little hockey puck-like discs, right? That when the shell hits the ground, usually you shoot them at the ground in front of protesters.
Right.
When they hit the ground, the shell opens up and all these little discs just spread out and smack a bunch of people all at once.
Right.
And all of a sudden they're like, ow, and snap out of their rioting mentality, hopefully,
right.
and go home. Right.
Right. That's the idea.
That's the idea of the blunt force round. There's also a beanbag round.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what it sounds. It shoots little square beanbags. Or there's some that look like tadpoles if you are, you know, aiming, if you want to be accurate.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's the sponge round, right, which is the cleanest of all the blunt force rounds.
Yeah, it's basically like a sponge bullet, which I imagine hurts pretty bad.
Yeah.
My nephew Noah shot me in the back over Christmas with this little gun that he got, a little air gun that shoots a little rubber pellets.
Oh, yeah, the little yellow ones?
Huh, yeah. I've
Airsoft?
I think so.
Yeah.
This is the second time for some reason in my life I volunteered to be shot because everyone was wondering how bad it hurts. And I was like, well, just shoot me. So I made my back taut with my shirt and he shot me in the back. And it hurt a lot.
Did it?
Yeah. It raised a big red welt. And yeah, it was not fun.
So I talked to Strickland of Tech Stuff, John Strickland.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He went to CES.
Uh huh.
And one of the things that was left out of this article was electrocution. Non-lethal electrocuting weapons.
Oh, that just shock people?
Specifically Taser, which is the company's name, by the way. But Strickland said that Taser was at CES in Vegas.
Tasing people?
Yes.
Are you serious?
Tasing people who wanted to be tased to find out how it felt, and they were tasing people. But he said there was something called a Taser Shockwave, which is an electroshock cannon.
Wow.
Right? I showed you
this.
Oh,
yeah, that's that thing?
So basically, it's just this array of tasers that you sit on like a mount, and you can stack them up.
Yeah, it's on four legs.
Stack them next to one another, so you create a barricade of tasers, and if people are running at you, you just deploy.
Wow.
And it tases, let's see, each little stack can tase six people at once, and you start stacking them up and side by side. That's a lot of people that you're tasing at once.
Strickland didn't get tased, did he?
There's no way Strickland got tased, no.
There's all kinds of cool non-lethal weapons, actually. I've seen those foam guns that, like, cover you in sticky goo and, like, sound things.
Yeah, yeah.
Flashbang grenades.
Gay bomb. That was created, right. That was thought of as a non-lethal weapon.
At the time, yeah, sure.
Patterson, right? Patterson Air Force Base, right?
Yes. They don't use all these in riots, though, obviously. They do use pepperball rounds, and those are basically modified paint guns, but instead of paint, it's filled with pepper spray. That hits you. It's not going to be very fun.
No.
It's going to sting, and then you're going to get that stuff in your face. They said they can also use water in case there are children or elderly in the crowd.
Right.
And that'll...
You don't want to pepper spray the elderly.
No, you don't. I just want to see the elderly rioting, though. That's what I was trying to figure out.
Buddy, wait until they take away Social Security, and then yeah. You'll see some elderly rioting.
Be a slow riot. Apparently, the water, though, will still cause a stinging sensation and have a similar effect.
Well, plus, if anyone who's savvy, a savvy rioter, and has been hit with a pepper ball spray, pepper ball round,
yeah,
may take this water round to be pepper spray and will start running, or it could right. have the same effect. It has a psychological effect, psychs them out.
Yeah, you're trying to disperse people.
There's also if you're into pepper spray or CS gas, which I'm going to go ahead and try to pronounce this now, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Chlorobenzalidine melanotrial. Chlorobenzalidine, yep. Chlorobenzalidine melanotrial.
Yep, and OC gas is oleoresin capsicum, which is what pepper spray is.
Did you look up the pronunciation of capsicum?
No, was that wrong?
I think that's right.
Oh,
it's either capsicum or capsicum.
Oh, well, I'm going with capsicum.
Okay, but you can both of those can be injected into an aerosol grenade.
Yeah,
which is tear gas grenade,
sure.
Right? And you can throw that into a crowd if you want to start a stampede and kill a bunch of people.
Yeah.
People get freaked out when you throw a grenade that starts spewing gas, right? They don't know what it is.
Sure.
But apparently this is very useful for crowd control. Like if you want the crowd to move right, you throw one of these to the left, on the left
right.
outskirts of the crowd, and everybody starts moving the way you want them to. Or if some people are just beating somebody up, you can throw that into a crowd to get them to lay off.
Right.
Or you can create a barricade of tear gas.
Yeah. The other thing, Josh, they have is dye rounds.
Yeah.
So sponge rounds, ferret rounds, we didn't talk about ferret rounds, but they penetrate windows and wooden barricades kind of to blast through something so that they can send in some gas.
Well, they have gas in the round.
Oh, they're actually in the round.
It wasn't spelled out. Yeah, I looked it up like it's in the round.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, all these things can be filled with dye, marker dye as well. So if you see like one of the leaders or someone who's doing something especially bad, you can pop them with one of these and all of a sudden the arrest team knows, hey, get that guy with the red splotch on his chest.
Or get that Smurf.
Or the blue splotch in that case.
Yeah.
And so if I would suggest, well, I'm not going to suggest that. If I was hit with one of these, I'd take off my shirt or something.
Sure.
Which would be a whole different kind of problem. Animals sometimes use dogs and horses to intimidate people.
Yeah, but not only that, horses and dogs are also relatively immune to OC and CS gas.
Just CS gas.
Oh, is it just CS?
Yeah, pepper spray is not good for anyone.
Okay.
That's just straight up hot. But that's, yeah, sure. I wonder how they test that.
You know exactly how they test it.
They spray a horse and say,
and then they're like, I wonder what happens if you tase a horse.
Josh,
Vegas.
What they're trying to do here is, in fact, they don't even call it a riot squad anymore. What they now call it is crowd management units.
Yes, we're on to the philosophy of riot control, chapter one, prevention.
Stop it before it starts.
Yeah.
Is the goal.
Yeah.
A lot of these things happen at planned
protests.
Mm-hmm.
So when they hear about this, someone applies for a permit to, mm-hmm. to stage a rally, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
If it's one that's particularly, they think, an incendiary, they'll send some a tactical unit in, and they'll talk to the people beforehand and say, hey, you can do this. You can right. go here, but don't do this and don't go there. We won't have any problems.
Right. And you're familiar with the battle for Seattle?
Yeah.
There was Direct Action Network was running the show for that, the World Trade Organization protest.
Mm-hmm.
And they met with the Seattle cops and were like, you know, this is what we'll do. Here's a great plan. We'll agree to this. But be forewarned, there are probably going to be people there that are not under our control. And there were. There was an anarchist group from Eugene, Oregon, and they're the ones who started just trashing the place.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, that didn't work out so well.
Well, the Seattle police were grossly underprepared for it. They did not, they were not ready for that.
Yeah.
At all. Chuck, you were talking, sorry to take us off on that tangent, but we were talking about prevention and
yeah.
how you meet with the cops will meet with you. They're going to be like, don't do this, don't do that. If this does happen, we're going to go from this passive, observant, but present kind of
sure.
mentality yeah. to, okay, now we're in a riot gear mentality.
Yeah, but they say it's still important to be unbiased. Like if it's, let's say, Democrats are opposing some Republican convention or something, the cops aren't supposed to let their biases figure into how they react. They're supposed to be unbiased and treat them like they're members of the community.
Mm-hmm.
And they say while they want to be not stormtroopers, you also can't appear to be subservient. You still have to like give the appearance at least that you're in charge.
Right.
So you got to walk that fine line between stormtrooping, beat you down mode, and you're just doing great things and I got no opinion on the matter.
I like your tie-dye shirt.
Yeah, I like your Madras shorts. It's very nice.
Oh yeah, those. So Chuck, if the ground rules are broken, apparently, and a riot does break out, the cops kind of switch modes, right?
Intimidation mode.
Yes. Again, the point, and all of this is theoretical law enforcement, but the point is to get this crowd to disperse, and it's based on the philosophy that they're just temporarily out of their minds and caught up in this mob mentality, and if you confront them with the strong arm of the law, they'll come to their senses and want to go home,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, and they do that. They'll like they're very tight with their precision with their movements, which is intimidating.
Right.
Apparently will like beat their shields with their batons and stomp their feet all at the same time.
Right.
And all this is the idea is to scare people into thinking, I don't want to be swallowed up into that square.
Right. They also pick and choose who they arrest or even who they mark with dye. Somebody
sure.
who is, if they see somebody engaged in a crime, they're probably going to try to arrest them depending on the severity of the crime. Or at least they'll probably try to mark that person for arrest later.
Right.
But if they see somebody, like if they see a group of people beating down one person or shooting poor Reginald Denny in the leg,
right.
They're going to go after those people because there's someone whose life is in danger. So they kind of triage, I think, in the middle of this chaos, they triage the, you know, who they're going to go after first. Right,
right. right. Makes sense. So we've talked about the rioters. Police, obviously, National Guard sometimes, trying to contain riots.
Right.
There have been some dark spots in the history of the world, and continue to be, where you get what's called a police riot, when the cops are the ones that are kind of, I don't know about instigating in all cases, but definitely the aggressors in the situation.
Yeah. There have definitely been police riots. The Haymarket riot was a very good example of that.
Which one was that?
That was the one in Chicago in 1886 that created the first May Day.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there were some striking workers, and the cops showed up and just started beating the tar out of them. The cops showed up. It was very tense. Someone threw a bomb at the cops and killed 8 cops.
Uh-huh.
And the cops went nuts and started firing on the crowd, killed 4 people. And ultimately, they went after these anarchists who founded this rally. And without any evidence that tied them to this bombing,
mm-hmm.
And they also think it's possibly an agent, a provocateur, someone who's paid by the cops to agitate the crowd by throwing this bomb through the bomb. But without tying these 8 guys to the bombing, they hung 4 of them. One of them committed suicide, and then 3 were finally pardoned.
Wow.
But that's the Haymarket riot. in Chicago.
You can't mention Chicago or Riot without talking about the 1968 Democratic National Convention.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Very big one. 10,000 anti-war protesters showed up because they wanted to protest.
Hippies.
Yippies, actually.
Well, the yippies were there, sure.
Yeah. Hubert Humphrey was the candidate that was to replace, who was it, Lyndon Johnson?
Yeah, we guess so, yeah.
And Humphrey was pro-war. Democrats didn't like that, so they went to protest. Richard Daley was the mayor. He didn't want any part of this stuff. He was pretty angry about it going in.
Mm-hmm.
Said things like, no one's going to protest in my city.
Yeah.
Built up big barricades around the convention center. Got a lot of cops and National Guardsmen involved. Apparently, 23,000 cops and National Guardsmen were on hand. And they had a stance on things, and they started beating the tar out of people.
Yeah. There was a have you seen Chicago 10?
No.
You should see it. You'd like it.
Is it part of the Chicago 7, 8, then 7?
Uh-huh.
It is?
But it's
were there 10 to begin with?
The filmmakers include the two defense lawyers who were cited for contempt.
Oh, okay.
And Bobby Seals, and then the Chicago 7.
Okay.
Which makes 10. But they it's all animated, like Waking Life.
Oh, really?
Or it's mostly animated. There's also, like, archival footage and all that. It's a documentary.
Huh.
But it's really, really cool. It's based on court transcripts, but that's animated.
I'll have to check that out.
It's very cool. But they were saying that people were staying in this park in Chicago,
uh-huh.
Jackson Park, Lincoln Park, one of the parks. And the cops were like, yeah, stay as long as you want until when the park closes at 11 o'clock. And then after that, we're going to go through and sweep the park and beat the tar out of anybody we find. And that, I think, ultimately set off the riots.
Oh, really?
When it got real bad was the cops wouldn't stop doing that.
Well, it got pretty out of hand, to say the least. And everyone from Mike Wallace and Dan Rather to Red Cross medics were roughed up.
Hunter Thompson?
Oh, was he there?
Yeah.
I'm sure he was roughed up.
They went into a hotel where people were staying and dragged people out of their rooms.
Really?
It was bad.
Well, I know that they said they threw so much tear gas on the scene that Hubert Humphrey was actually bothered in the shower in his hotel by the tear gas.
Wow.
So, that was a dark spot on our nation's history for sure.
Yeah, I think Hunter Thompson wrote an article on it. Like, it's probably fear and loathing at the Democratic National Convention.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I said Detroit earlier. We would be remiss if we didn't mention that. In 1943, this was the case of rumors of things that never happened sparking a riot. There was already a race fight going on at an amusement park.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was two rumors. One that some white men had thrown a black woman who was holding a baby into a lake.
Right. They're like, throwing a white woman into the lake
wasn't bad enough.
Right. Yeah. And then they're like, and she was holding a baby.
Right.
They're like, what?
And then white people heard news that a mob of black folks had assaulted a white woman. Neither of these things even happened, but that was my point earlier. It doesn't matter if it happened or not. There were racial tensions in Detroit at the time mm-hmm. in 1943, and this set it off. And cops apparently were shooting fleeing black people in the back.
Yeah.
That was the rumor. Well, I don't know about rumor.
How many died?
25 black folks and 9 white folks were killed. $2 million in property damage, and yet another black spot on our nation's history when it comes to rioting. But, you know, they say they've got it figured out now.
It's not just our nation either. Right now in Moscow, they have race riots going on.
Yeah, Tunisia, too. There's rioting going on as we speak.
Yeah, but that's anti-government rioting.
Yeah, this guy set himself on fire, a 26-year-old student who had had a college degree and dismal prospects for work.
He was being taxed. I think he was like a merchant or something in a market, and he was being taxed or something unfairly, he felt.
Well, he was trying to sell fruit and vegetables, and they basically told him he couldn't do it at all because he didn't have the proper permit, and that was the only way he could make money. So he set himself on fire, and now through like Facebook, the word has spread to riot in Tunisia, and it's still going on.
And apparently Anonymous sent a message to the Tunisian government telling him to open up the internet.
Oh, really?
They have it locked down like China does.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's happening all over the place.
Yes, it is. It's a crazy time to be alive, my friend.
It is.
Well, if you want to learn more about how to control a riot, if your kids are ever going crazy or something like that, you can type in riot control in the handy search bar at howstuffworks.com.
Sorry to cut that one off abruptly. That was the Stuff You Should Know episode called How to Control a Riot.
originally podcast at HowStuffWorks.com on January 28, 2011. This is the radio version of the Stuff You Should Know podcast. Now for part two, Josh and Chuck examine five successful counterfeiters. This episode was originally podcast on May 13, 2010.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. This is Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuck Bryant. This is Stuff You Should Know, eh?
To live and die in L.A.
Yes, Chuck just did a little, I don't even know if that's foreshadowing. I am really off my game today, so...
No, you're not.
Yeah, I am.
You're so on it.
I am. what Chuck brought up... See, listen to me. What Chuck brought up to live in... I want to get through this sentence. What Chuck brought up to live and die in L.A. for...
Yeah?
Is because we're talking about counterfeiting today.
And that's the best counterfeit movie in history.
It is.
Easily.
And it is. And we've talked about it before, but I think it's worth talking about again, like
sure.
You just did.
Mm-hmm.
It's great.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Moving on.
So, Chuck, counterfeiting, as you may or may not know, is a dying crime.
A lost art.
It really is. And actually, this is one of those old school types of criminal activity
mm-hmm.
that... people who are good at it have the respect of law enforcement.
Yeah.
I was reading an article about this bust of some counterfeiting ring, and it amounted to just some guy with an inkjet printer who was
right.
printing off, you know, terrible, terrible currency.
On fiber paper.
Right. And this Secret Service guy, who's like a 22-year vet, just shook his head in disgust. And he's like, it's a dying art. Like, you just... You don't see good paper any longer.
Yeah, it's definitely a lost art. And I know this sounds goofy, but I kind of like the idea of, since it doesn't happen that much anymore, I can say this, of counterfeiting. Like, instead of a thief, anyone can throw a chair through a window
yeah.
and go, like, break into a cash register at night.
Right.
But to think, like, I'll print money that's so believable
yeah.
that you can pass it.
Yeah.
It's like, it was artistry, for sure.
It is. And when researching this article, there was a common theme among these great counterfeiters, these five most successful counterfeiters, that they all were just, they had tremendous guts.
Yeah.
They tried to break out of jail at every turn.
Yeah.
And they were just really admirable criminals.
Yeah, and most of them wrote books about it, too,
yeah,
which
yeah.
is interesting.
It's a good way to make some money afterwards.
You don't write a book about my life as a flat-screen TV thief.
No.
No.
And if you do, no one reads it. It's self-published.
Sure.
So, Chuck, let's get into this, all right?
All right.
Now, we're going to talk about some of these successful counterfeiters, and we should also add a caveat here. Successful doesn't mean that they never got caught.
Oh, no. They
all got caught. We don't know about those counterfeiters.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. The ones who got caught but still had these tremendous careers are the ones we're going to talk about. And we're going to do it chronologically, buddy, starting with a guy named Stephen Burroughs.
Stevie. He was born in New Hampshire, Josh, in the 1700s,
uh-huh.
mid-1700s, and was raised throughout the United States, and I think that you have one of the best sentences you've ever written in this article.
Which one?
From an early age, he showed distinct signs of acute chicanery.
Why did you read that like Anthony Hopkins?
Oh, that was Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah.
Oh, you said, why did I?
Yeah.
That wasn't supposed to be Anthony Hopkins.
Okay.
That was just my newsreel voice.
Yeah, that was good.
Thank you. And he was a little mischievous guy all his life, it sounds like.
He apparently gained a reputation as the worst boy in town at a very young age. He stole a bunch of watermelons from a local farmer, and he joined the search party to find the thief.
That shows he's smart.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And I think at age 14, he ran away, joined the merchant navy, ended up basically being the de facto ship doctor.
Well, he deserted...
That's right.
He went to the army.
Joined the army.
Deserted the army.
Uh-huh.
Then went to college, bailed on college, and then became like a de facto doctor on a boat.
Right. And which led him to say, you know what? I could probably get away with posing as stuff. His father was a clergyman, so he decided that he was going to pose as the leader of a church, which he did successfully for 6 months.
Right.
Led the congregation, like mass, everything.
Oh, yeah.
And he... probably could have done that indefinitely because, you know, people aren't that suspicious of preachers usually. But he got busted passing some counterfeit money in Concord, right?
Springfield.
Close enough.
Yes. And then he was sent to jail.
Yeah.
And then he thought, I bet a good way to escape from jail would be to set the jail on fire.
Yeah.
And it worked.
Yeah, it did.
Because he successfully escaped.
Yeah, he fled to Canada, actually. And did he get caught again?
Well, that's where he led the most serious counterfeiting ring was when he went to Canada.
Right. So he was in Canada, and he led this ring for years, and then suddenly he just decided to reform himself.
Yeah.
He gave up crime, started supporting himself by tutoring wealthy Canadian children, or the children of wealthy Canadians, I should say.
Yes. He founded a library. Isn't that what you said?
Yeah. He became kind of like a cultural benefactor up there.
And crazy.
Even though people were aware of who he was, they still respected him because the stuff he did was just so respectable.
Sure. Yeah. They're like, yeah, he printed some phony bills. He built us a library.
He built a library. And he died in 1840. But before that, he wrote a book, like you said a lot of them do, called Memoirs of My Own Life.
That's the best memoir title in memoir history.
Yes, it is.
Memoirs of My Own Life.
Yeah, so it's still in print, apparently. I haven't read it.
I haven't either.
Well, let's... Moving on.
Number four?
Yeah.
Is, drum roll, The Lavender Hill Mob, which I found out was a movie from 1951 with Alec Guinness.
Try researching them.
I know. Yeah. That's all you see is the movie.
Yeah.
But it's unrelated.
No.
Not related at all.
Right. Instead, the Lavender Hill Mob actually are of fairly recent origin. They were operating in the 90s in Great Britain, around Lavender Hill, I would imagine. They were founded by this guy named Stephen Jory, and this guy was awesome. He was what they call an old school rogue, and that's a quote.
Uh-huh.
And another guy named Kenneth Mainstone, who's a retired printer, and Jory recruited Mainstone to come up with some counterfeiting plates, right?
Right.
And they did very successfully. And by the way, Jory is widely credited as establishing the knockoff perfume market.
Yeah, I found he actually bribed a perfumer to get recipes,
mm-hmm.
and by the time it was all said and done, had bottled 5 million phony Chanel No. 5s.
Really?
It's 5 million. They had a factory in Acapulco making this stuff. That's how successful he was.
If you love Giorgio, if you like Giorgio, you'll love Ooh La La and like a little spray aerosol can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When was the last time you wore cologne?
Oh, it's been a long time.
Yeah, I wore cologne when I was like 17, I think was the last time.
I'd say it's about it for me.
You know, it's funny, when I lived in Yuma, Arizona, all those dudes wore cologne.
Yeah, because everybody's sweaty out there.
Well, I don't know. There's just kind of it was a different culture. And they're like, you don't wear cologne? And they're like,
they have like gel in their hair?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I know the culture you're speaking of.
Yeah, the Jersey Shore type of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so the Lavender Hill Mob, right? They were very successful. They printed about 50 million pounds worth of fake notes. And not pounds by weight, but pound by, their currency.
The English currency.
Yeah.
They also sold fake stamps, which I thought was sort of ingenious.
It is. But at the same time, it's like, look, you just made 50 million pounds of fake currency.
Right.
And one way to get rid of counterfeit money is not to just pass it, but you can actually sell it for, pennies on the dollar.
Right.
To people who know that it's counterfeit and are going to go pass it themselves. But even for pennies on the dollar, that's still many millions of pounds.
Oh, yeah.
And these guys are making stamps on the side.
Yeah. Well, apparently,
I just thought it was a little odd.
It was a little odd. Apparently, the first bills didn't work out so great, though. Did you hear about that? The Queen of England looked like she had a beard. And so maybe that's why they were making stamps, until they perfected the note making.
Yeah.
Which they did, because they fooled UV detectors. They got so good at it.
Yeah, and actually they got good enough that the Bank of England actually changed their design for their 20-pound note because of the Lavender Hill Mob's activities and success.
Pretty awesome.
It is. Yeah.
And he wrote a book, Jory did, before he died. Just died a couple of years ago, didn't he?
2006. Yeah.
It's under two titles. The first one was called Funny Money. Decent. The second one was great. Second one was called Loads of Money, and that's one word, Loads of. Loads of Money, the true story of the world's largest ever counterfeiting ring.
Nice.
Colon in there as well.
Yeah, it kind of classes up your book when you have a colon in there.
Loads of Money.
Yeah. We should write a movie about that guy.
We should.
All right, Chuck, on to the Nazis.
Yeah, I didn't know this.
Most people think of the Nazis as like the worst fascist state to ever emerge in the history of humanity.
Not
probably
true.
Worst state ever.
Oh, no. That is true.
Not first. Worst.
Right.
Because Mussolini wasn't all that successful. You know, they directly murdered 10 million marginalized people.
Yeah.
Including Jews, Roma, Catholics, homosexuals, and others.
Sure.
They invaded Poland and France and other countries. But they also ran, arguably, the most successful counterfeiting ring in the history of humanity. There were a lot of in the history of humanities with Nazis. Almost all of them were horrible. Actually, all of them were horrible.
This is the least horrible thing they've ever done.
Probably, but it was going to pan out pretty bad in the end.
Yeah, they made about 650 million pound notes, which would be about 7 billion bucks today.
Right, which was about 15% of the currency in circulation in Great Britain at the time.
Right, and their brilliant idea was to fly over England and drop cash money from planes.
Right. They actually figured out, and this was called Operation Bernhard, after Bernhard Kruger.
Yeah,
who was an SS officer who was in charge of this operation.
Yeah, the head of the operation named the operation after himself.
Basically, what they did was they went around and figured out what nearly dead people in their camps used to be printers in the time before the war, and they identified them and drafted them to work in what was called the Devil's Workshop,
right,
which was like a secret printing press or printing office at, what is it? You speak German. What camp?
Saskatchewan? No. Schaffhausen.
Nice, Chuck. So they had some guys there, all assembled to crack the English currency. And they
Sachsenhausen.
Did. And they did successfully, leading to the 650 million pound notes.
Yeah, and they didn't drop it from the plane, though. They laundered it.
Right.
Used some of that money to, like, import things.
Yeah.
And this isn't factually backed up, but there is rumor that they actually used that money to pay for the rescue of Mussolini.
Did they really?
Yeah.
Well, they apparently made a bunch of cash. They gave the money to a German businessman who served as a front for him to launder it, and he bought anything of value that he could get his hands on.
I bet.
With this money. And apparently it wasn't a secret. Like, England had known since, like, 1939.
Right.
That this was going on, and they tried to close their borders to incoming currency, but it didn't really work.
Right.
They finally cracked the American $100 bill just as their camp was liberated.
Yeah.
And the Nazis knew these guys were coming, so they took all the printing by these guys, the Allies. They took the printing stuff and threw it in the lakes, blew stuff up with explosives.
Right.
I don't know why they were trying to cover this aspect of the Holocaust up. You know?
Right.
And they were about to execute everybody who was involved, and the Allies showed up and saved the day.
Yeah, and I think we should point out the idea behind all of this was to undermine the economies of England and the United States.
Oh, did we not point that out?
No.
Oh.
Which
yeah,
is,
that's a pretty important part.
That was the plan. They weren't just like, ooh, we'll get English money and then we'll buy things.
Right. Because, you know, if you have a sudden influx of cash, a lot of cash on the market
right.
leads to inflation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Indeed. There was a BBC TV show, Josh, about this in 1980 called Private Schultz. And then one of the Jewish prisoners forced to do this was named Adolf Berger.
Yeah.
And he later wrote a book, and that book was turned into a movie that won Best Foreign Language Film in 2008.
Yeah. What's
called,
it called?
The Counterfeiters in English.
Nice.
Don't ask me what it was in German.
I'll have to check it out.
Yeah.
Moving on, Chuck.
Moving on to number two.
Charles Ulrich.
Yes. Not related to Robert.
Urich,
as far as I know, because there's two different names.
Right. Now, this guy was another kind of dashing counterfeiter filled with derring do, and he was also a ladies' man, actually.
Derring do.
I couldn't help. There's no other better way to describe it.
Acute chicanery. Yeah, he was a ladies' man, right?
Yeah, it actually led to his downfall, right? He was a polygamist. And he wasn't shy about it. He was like Bill Paxton, for goodness sake.
Right. And this was in the 1860s in New York. He, and like most of these counterfeiters, he was a gifted engraver of plates.
Right. So the local mob figures out that this guy is a gifted engraver of plates, and they corral him to try to get him in, well, working for them.
Right.
And he does, and he ends up getting in trouble and ends up forming his own mob, his own gang. and with all the women included, right?
Mm-hmm.
He finally gets caught in 1868 and stands trial. It was in Cincinnati, and he got 12 years in the federal pokey. And by his own estimation, he printed about $80,000 worth of phony bills.
A lot of dough back then.
Which is equal to about $1.3 million in 2008 dollars, right?
Right.
But what was his downfall, Chuck? I said women, but specifically what?
Well, like you said, he was a just sort of a blatant polygamist, made no bones about it, and he engaged, moved all around, engaged in relationships, and never broke off the old ones. Eventually, he moved his wife in to live with he and his girlfriend and a third woman.
Right.
And one of them finally said, you know what? I'm going to turn you in, jerk.
Actually, all of them turned on him.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And they turned him in, and that's where the Cincinnati trial came from. But before that, he had been incarcerated, and in the grand tradition of counterfeiters, he broke out and actually led the cops on a chase across the Niagara River, like right at the falls, and made it across, actually, into Canada and escaped.
And he was like, who's that lady in the barrel?
Right, yeah.
As he was going.
And if that's not daring do, I don't know what is.
That's daring do, my friend. Is. That's okay. A cute chicanery.
You really like that, don't you?
It's great.
All right, so last one, buddy. And this guy's pretty familiar.
Yeah, everyone's probably heard of Frank Abagnale.
Yeah.
Because the Stevie Spielberg movie, Catch Me If You Can.
Yeah.
Tommy Hanks.
It was made at a time when Spielberg unwittingly had a fake or a stolen Rockefeller in his collection.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I loved this movie. Did you like it?
Yeah, I liked it too.
It was just, I don't know, it was when Spielberg had kind of put out some stinkers and everything was so serious, and then he just kind of did a fun, entertaining heist movie.
Right, and it's one of those movies you can lay on the couch and watch like for the 50th time on like a Sunday.
Yeah, agreed.
But they never show it on TV.
Yeah, I think it ran on like TNT for a while because I saw it.
That's it, though.
Yeah. I love this movie. Leo DiCaprio obviously played Frank.
And, funny story, when Abagnale found out DiCaprio was going to portray him, he was worried because he didn't know if Leonardo DiCaprio would be able to be smooth enough to play him accurately.
He's like the smoothest dude on the planet.
He is smooth. He's like
Does
Billy
he know
D.
who he's
Williams.
Dated?
Oh, Leo?
Yeah.
No, I don't think this guy cares. I don't think he thinks Leo DiCaprio holds a candle to him.
Goodness me. You can land Giselle. And then,
well, so can Tom Brady.
Well, look at him, dude. Yeah. Stud quarterback?
Yeah, but I mean...
Chiseled out of stone?
He's a quarterback.
Shut up. All right. He did most of his work in his teens and 20s, which is the remarkable thing about his story.
Yeah.
And he was a check forger.
Yes, as anybody who's seen the movie can tell you. And actually, between the ages of 16 and 21, he cashed more than $2.5 million in fake checks in all 50 states and 26 countries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's some serious work. And he was also a confidence man.
Yes, he was.
Because he would not only write fake checks, but he would masquerade as you saw in the film, like an airline pilot or a doctor or an attorney.
Yeah.
A professor, I think he did at one point.
Yeah.
And fooled everybody.
Yeah. And he just forged whatever documents he needed to prove that he had the education or training or resume or whatever, and he'd get hired, which made him a good con man.
Absolutely.
Which made him, Chuck, smooth.
He said, catch me if you can.
Sucker.
A few things here, Josh, that are similar and different from real life and in the movie, because they always beef it up a little bit in the movies.
Yeah.
He did actually pose as a federal agent when they busted in on him.
Yeah.
And kind of snuck out the back door.
Yeah.
Said, keep looking.
Yeah, he ordered the feds who were looking for him to keep looking. He said he was like a treasury agent or something like
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. And yeah, and he was there first.
Yeah.
He actually did escape from a moving plane taxiing on the runway.
That's pretty serious, dude.
Yeah, that's awesome. That really happened. However, in real life, he never saw his father again after he left home. And he had a real problem with his parents' divorce. I mean, like... more so than any kid I've ever heard.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he would fantasize about meeting his parents again and them being proud of him and them getting back together because they were proud of his exploits.
Weird. That's kind of like Ralphie dreaming that he was going to go blind from having to eat soap for swearing. You remember? It was soap poisoning.
He was one of four kids. And in the movie, I think he was an only child.
Yeah.
Hannity, the character Hanratty.
Yeah, Tom Hanks' character?
Yeah, it was actually a guy named Joe Shea. They changed his name.
Weird.
Yeah, I don't know why. Because they said in the original script it was Joe Shea, and I could never find any reason why they changed it to Hanratty.
Did they say anything about Captain America? Did he use the Captain America alias?
No, I didn't notice.
Yeah.
He was in the film, actually, as one of the French policemen that nabbed him at the
end. Oh, really?
Yeah, he had a little cameo.
Yeah, because he did a stint in the French jail.
French prison?
French prison.
Mm-hmm. He is actually married a woman. As soon as he went straight, he married a woman, still married to her today.
Mm-hmm.
He's got three sons, and one of his sons is a federal agent.
Cool.
And he did remain friends with Tom Hanks. Or not Tom Hanks.
With Tom Hanks.
Joe Shea.
Joe Shea, gotcha.
Yeah.
And he does consulting on like identity fraud and, you know, bank security and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, everyone on your list wrote a book except for number two, Charles Ulrich.
Yeah.
Well, and the Nazis.
Yeah.
But the guy wrote a book.
One of the guys involved. Yeah, yeah, Charles Ulrich was just too involved with the ladies.
I guess so.
Waste time writing a book.
He should write a book about that.
Chuck, do you want to finish this?
You want to wrap this turkey up and put it in the oven?
Exactly.
This episode of Stuff You Should Know is brought to you by GoToMeeting, the affordable way to meet with clients and colleagues. For your free 30-day trial, visit gotomeeting.com/stuff.
Okay, so if you want to see some pictures about the guys that we were just talking about, one I couldn't find, so I used a picture of Dartmouth College. It was the best I could come up with, and I apologize for that.
Sorry,
you
Dartmouth.
You can type in counterfeiters, counterfeiters, in the handy search bar at howstuffworks.com, which leads us to listener mail. Thank the Lord.
Josh, I'm going to call this Synesthetes Wrote In.
Yeah, we got a bunch of them, didn't we?
We did. It's cool to know they're out there, being all weird. this is three quickies. I edited them down, guys. First one's from Jonathan. When I hear spoken words, I see the written forms of the words in my visual field. I see them much the same way I see a memory. They don't scroll across my visual field like a stock ticker. Rather, they appear in flashes in seemingly random positions and sizes. I see the words most clearly when I'm deeply focused on the content of speech, like at a lecture, or when I'm listening to lyricized music. I often even see words when I'm dreaming. As for the color, the best I can do is say that they are a generic sans serif font, white fill with black borders.
Cool.
And he's a researcher at UC San Diego. He said, perhaps I should just ask Professor Ramachandran next time he's sitting across from me at Perks Cafe.
Ooh la la.
And it's like, dude, if you
of
see that guy,
you should ask him. Yeah, I'm glad that we could bring these two together. It's like the mom with her son who went off to college.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that's from Jonathan. Here's the second one from Ben. When I was 8 or 9 years old, my best friend moved to another town. That summer, after not hearing from him in a while, I decided to give him a call once I walked home from another friend's house. A couple of seconds later, my right wrist suddenly had an intense pain and throbbing for no apparent reason. I iced my wrist, it made it feel better, and when I got home, I was still very confused why it happened. I called my best friend to tell him about this weird thing, only to discover that he was also in pain, waiting for his mom to get him to the hospital. Seems he and his brother were playing Indiana Jones and the escape from the closing garage door when he landed the wrong way and busted his right wrist. I'm a pretty logical guy, but that is really creepy and 100% true. Is that the work of neurons or a minor psychic event? Who knows?
Who knows?
And this last one is from Jordan in New Zealand. He's a Kiwi. We love New Zealand. I associate all numbers and letters with colors, and my mother and I also used to argue at times about what color a letter is.
Just like Nabokov.
Yeah, and they didn't know that they were synesthetes.
Just like the famous book by Nabokov.
Awesome. Police, though. God, what a bad show that was. I thought it might also interest you to know that I experience music as a projection of colors. I can only explain it as a sort of mixture of fireworks and a fountain.
Cool.
A stream of water shoots in the air, changes colors and the shape in relation to the music. A loud beat is annoying because it's like a pulse ripple in the pond. It distracts and muddies the other tones. Although it is sometimes annoying, I find music distracting. It can get distracting, and I still find it very difficult to focus on a conversation if there's too much background noise or music. But now I can actually partially mute, colors so I can concentrate on music, and while I still see no colors, I do see the explosions. So like a classical piano piece is really intense. He says, he still sees, oh, I'm sorry, he still sees colors and explosions even though he's muted it, but he's lessened it to the point where he can actually listen to the music and not go crazy.
Gotcha.
Goodness, I'm having an off day too.
Wait, what do you mean too?
If I'm talking to someone and music is playing in the background, I can focus on the speaker much easier than I was previously able, thanks to his new muting ability. So, nice. That's from Jordan in New Zealand.
That's cool.
And we heard from other synesthetes, and I just couldn't get them all in the air, so thanks
to
all.
Yeah, we heard from one guy who was like, wait, I thought everybody saw the date physically wrap around them.
Right.
Yeah. It's just pretty cool.
Yeah. Join us on Facebook and Twitter.
Yes, please do.
At SYSK Podcast for Twitter, and just look up Stuff You Should Know. Website, I think it's called website.
Yeah,
on Facebook.
Yeah, yeah. Do those things.
Yeah, we're having a good
time. Send us an email about anything at all, right, Chuck?
Sure.
I've got nothing, so just send us an email, will you? That's stuffpodcast@howstuffworks.com.
That was the Stuff You Should Know episode called Five Successful Counterfeiters, originally podcast at howstuffworks.com on May 13th, 2010. You can subscribe to Stuff You Should Know and other podcasts at howstuffworks.com as well as on iTunes. This is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and online at WFMU.org.
Sense. Something tells me. me I'm a fool to let you treat me so cruel. But nevertheless, I say again, you gotta be waiting, sitting in the bar. The fence, wondering if I have any sense. Something tells me I'm a fool that you treat me so cruel. Nevertheless, I say you gotta be waiting, sitting in the park.
This is Stacy from Brooklyn. I love listening to Bessie playing sweet soul music during WFMU Shock and October Month. I'm going to go to WFMU.org and make my pledge now.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Thanks, Stacy, for that vote of confidence there. Hey, guys, you're listening to WFMU. So happy to be back on the air. It's been a few months. My name's Betsy Nichols, and I'm filling in for Miss Define Wine tonight. Hope you guys are doing great out there. And as Stacy so briefly mentioned, we are having a secret marathon that we don't talk about on the air. But if you could please go to WFMU.org and make a pledge tonight, that would be great. The station really needs your help. And we're trying to keep the programming as usual here during